I'm Lee Wade, and you're listening to Translucent, a series that amplifies trans voices, humanizes our community, and creates space for the real everyday conversations that don't make headlines. On today's episode of Translucent, we hear from Beck and Dash, the two amazing people behind Queernecks. Their podcast is funny, heartfelt, and unapologetically real, digging into what it's like to be queer in Appalachia, while sharing stories, laughs, and insights that stick with you.
I'm Beck, and I go by she, her.
I'm Dash, and I use he, him pronouns. Thanks for asking us to be here.
I had fun on you guys' podcast a few weeks ago. I've definitely been looking forward to having you on. What inspired you to create Queernecks, and how did the idea first come together?
Inspiration, I think, was it came out of a personal need. I was sitting around feeling lonely one day and missing friends who were from a similar background as me. I moved out of Appalachia into a place that's pretty hardcore different culturally. Very nice people here, but those shared experiences had disappeared from my life, and I thought the word Queernecks just appeared in my mind and made me kind of laugh one day. And I don't know, it just, as soon as it formed into something that I thought we should put on the air, Beck is the first person I thought of, the only person I thought of, like, who could make this project entertaining for people. Like, just knowing that the way we've been friends for 12, 13 years now, and just knowing that our friendship has been like that, has been intellectual and fun and caring and all that at the same time. So I just texted her and said, hey, I got a stupid idea.
And I was like, that sounds like a lot of fun. I'm also kind of removed from Appalachia, and it's nice to go home sometimes. And physically, when you can't do that, it's nice to hang out with somebody like Dash.
Once my boss sent me you all's podcast, I've been listening to it every Monday when you all drop an episode.
Cool.
I saw this last episode you interviewed
Willie Edward Taylor Carver Jr.
Yes, wonderful episode, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, he was. Well, and you were our very first interview, and so it was real nice to have already had that experience. We're not journalists. We're not podcasters, really, until very recently, and we certainly aren't journalists. So being able to approach him, having had experience with you under our belt, was a big help. But yeah, he was – I really recommend his book. Just a really insightful thinker, I think, and writer.
I'm definitely going to add his book on my list to read. Yeah, so I read the article that you sent me last week. And in the article, you were talking about you and Beck's motivation for creating Queernecks and you wanting to reclaim the word redneck and talk about what both of your experiences has been like growing up in Appalachia as queer people. So my second question for you is, can you share a moment when you realized that there was a real need for queer Appalachian voices to be amplified or heard in public media?
Well, that goes along with the thing that was missing from my life in terms of community, is that wasn't out there, that wasn't accessible, that's not on the air, it's not on TV. There's not representation a person can look to when they're feeling. I was feeling homesick, and I wanted some Appalachian, you know, from where my home was. I couldn't find anything but Dope Sick. I watched the whole series of Dope Sick because I wanted to see, I just felt, wanted to feel close to Appalachia. And you have to, like, engage with heavily traumatized media to get representations of Appalachia. And the main character in that show, they explore that narrative that's about the opioid epidemic in Appalachia. They made a very specific decision to explore that story through a queer character. There are times since leaving Appalachia where I get the question a lot, like, you must be so happy to be out of that area as a queer person or something like that. Like, it's very clear that people outside the region assume that there either aren't queer Appalachians or that we all hate being Appalachian or we all hate our homes or something like that. And I'm well aware of the political landscape of where I'm from, but I also know that that's not the whole story. And I believe Appalachia also is a great role model in mutual aid models, in advocacy, coalitional, intersectional activism. All anybody has to do is just take a quick glance at the work that's going on there at the grassroots level, and they will get a different image of Appalachia. And one the thing that's very significant about that is that work is almost always led by queer and trans folks who are native to the region, people of color, indigenous folks. Like, those are the people who are at the center of that work in Appalachia. I think there's a totally different landscape that people aren't aware of. And I would love to just bridge that gap.
You were talking a little bit about like some of the stereotypes and like misconceptions that people have about like Appalachia. And, you know, Appalachia is often, it's often stereotyped in mainstream media. What do you wish people understood about Appalachian culture and queer life there?
I want people definitely to know that queer Appalachians we're not self-hating queers, and we're not self-hating Appalachians. Like, we can love and appreciate both those pieces of our identity.
I agree with Dash. It's a lot about resilience. the stereotypes about Appalachia are not very kind. There's a lot of ignorance and misunderstanding of the way that people are there. We may be a little redneck, but we're still caring and loving. Some of the communities that I've been in down there are the most loving people that I could imagine. And I think that gets lost in translation sometimes. They think we're just all the guy from the Mountain Dew bottle, right? Barefoot and missing teeth and holy clothes and things like that. And there are certainly people like that in Appalachia, but that's not the majority. And I think people forget about that, about how diverse we are.
And those people, like every sort of experience that a person can have is valid and like deserves our appreciation and our attention to what their experiences are. There's a long history. There's a great book I recommend to just about everybody who wants to learn more about like the history of the social construct, the social cultural construct that the Appalachian region is, how it's different from the mountain chain. Nancy Eisenberg wrote a book called White Trash, The 400-Year History of Class in America. And it's comprehensive. If you're a history person, you're going to love this book. And she traces this lineage of the construct of white trash as disposable, as disgusting, as less than, and that you can still see that very clearly today. So you'll see a phenomenon this is visible clear as day on social media or in regular media, news media. Say there's a natural disaster or some tragedy befalls a region in Appalachia, the wider majority discourse will be, well, they deserved it, essentially. You know, this is what you get when you do this or that, when you, like, somehow any decision that a person could make could warrant a mudslide that kills, what was it, 30 children or something. And so we're just really ready as a country to cheer on the misfortune and punishment of this entire region. And I think a lot of us haven't really critically examined why that is, why we're so willing to do that. And just like with any other form of unlearning and doing the work and whatever you want to call it, it's uncomfortable. You have to question some assumptions you have, and some things, like any other bias, it's just stuff we didn't ask to know, but we do know it. And we have to take ownership over that and examine and deprogram.
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree. There's a lot of things that we grew up, you know, learning just from the people around us about different cultures and different people that, you know, we do have to begin exploring and unlearning and relearning in order to move forward as a country, as a society.
You know, the thing is that most of us are, when we grow up, we're around a lot of people that look like us usually. And so when we learn about other people that are different from us racially or socioeconomically or whatever, it's basically secondhand information. And so there's an example that I use when we're talking about this in class. There was a group of three-year-olds, and they did some testing and questioning, and they asked them to describe a Native American. And these three-year-olds didn't have any idea what they were talking about, right? And then they asked them to describe an Indian. And because they had all seen Peter Pan, they were able to describe the Indian and the stereotypical feather in the cap and all of those kinds of things. And I'm not saying that three-year-olds are prejudiced or anything, but the the foundation for the some of the things that we believe, some of the stereotypes that we have, really do come from socialization at that such an early age. And that's one of the reasons you have to think twice about some things, because it's still perfectly acceptable to make a joke about a hillbilly or a redneck or yeehaw or whatever, you know. And that's really, there are real people living those lives and those identities. And we wouldn't allow that. We wouldn't allow racist jokes or anything like that, but we absolutely allow classist jokes all the time. So
you can look up redneck or hillbilly costume on Amazon. And that I did that for an article that I was writing once, and it was, man, very illustrative, the results for that.
I bet. Though, have you ever seen the American parties that they throw in, like, Germany and Sweden and places like that?
Yes, and I love that.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
It is. But it's a lot of redneck culture that they bring is. Into it. Yeah.
Yeah, like around the world, we like Appalachia or rednecks or whatever, we are the pejorative of America. And that I think also comes back to whiteness, to hegemonic whiteness, because hegemonic whiteness is both ashamed of white trash, but also heavily depends on the continued existence of white trash so that it can be responsible for racism. It can be responsible for the perpetuation of, or even owning all of the historical sins of racism. And that way, capital W, whiteness, proper white people, as they see themselves, they don't have to ask themselves whether they're racist. They don't have to question their own assumptions, because they're never going to be as bad as they've convinced themselves and the rest of the world white trash is. And none of this, by the way, anybody listening, is to say that there is not hardcore racism in Appalachia or in red states or anything like that. We know. We absolutely know. In fact, we know our history better than anybody else has ever had to examine their own history.
Well, what would you all say that listeners should take away from Kurenix? Like, you know, just about their assumptions.
There's this respectability politics on my mind that makes me want to say, I hope that they change their mind about how, what we're like, right? And they learn that not that we can, for, you know, be college professors or whatever.
I definitely love the work that you two are doing with Kurenix, and I think a lot of people listening would also love it. What I love so much about Kurenix is, like, you all have genuine conversations about anything, and then there's these, like, punches of humor that come out in different parts of the episode. How do humor and storytelling help you challenge misconceptions or biases about both being queer and around the redneck identity?
What I have found is that when you can make people laugh, they like you a lot, usually. And so I learned as a young kid that that's a good way to make friends and that kind of thing. And the humor, just it's just part of who I am. I can't help go 5 minutes without making a little jokey joke, you know, even about the most serious things, because, you know, sometimes you just need to break the tension or whatever it is. And there's ways to make jokes about things, as long as you're aware and culturally sensitive about things. There's ways to make jokes about almost anything. But it really does help people like you more. And then that was always my strategy, get people to like me for who I am and then let them figure out I was queer. Right. So there was a lot, because my parents, they ran a bingo hall for a long time. So I had a lot of older people in my life, because that's usually who plays bingo. And so they would like me as a person and then eventually find out that I was queer. And then, oops, it's too late. You already like me. Ha ha.
No take backsies.
Yep.
Well, and that's also playing into that, like, most people are far, in practice, are less concerned with people who are different than them, than with differences, right? They're less bigoted than they may think they are to begin with. I don't know if that made any sense. Given forewarning, a person who knows, for instance, that I'm transgender and they're going to have to spend a lot of time with me or be in the bathroom with me, they may think about a lot about that, and they start to try to solve problems that haven't appeared yet. They start down this slippery slope of what if this and what if that, and by the time they get into the situation with me and I'm just a normal person who happens to have this one difference from them, the damage is done. And so it's harder to backtrack to a place of where we have a lot more in common than different once you've made it all the way down that slippery slope. And I think the fastest way to build rapport with somebody is with humor. Because humor almost always comes from a safe place, but like humor is messy. It can say whack stuff, you know, like jokes are, they kind of push boundaries and stuff. And so to be able to even joke with someone, you have to be in a safe place together, because otherwise it doesn't work. You're not going to do it. You're not going to sit with somebody and let them make jokes about something unless you have come together a little bit. And that's just kind of who we are too. Like everybody I know back home, humor is very important to them. Humor is very important to my dialect. My dialect in particular, my native dialect, is very euphemistic. It's very jocular. It's very much like wordplay and puns. It's like central to how we even build and maintain community.
Yeah, I love the way that you phrase that. And I was just thinking about the way that you two were talking about humor, like, you know, like in my upbringing as well, humor is, you know, how we got through some of the darkest moments and, you know, struggling with things day to day, you know, just making jokes to feel in community with each other. And
I think humor is also a tool of resistance. It's humor can be kind of revolutionary. Think about there was one person in like ancient, you know, Europe or something like that, right, who could mock the king, and it's the jester. Anybody else makes jokes at the king's expense, they're beheaded or whatever, but the jester's whole existence is to mock power. And so sometimes I'll sort of proudly identify as a clown, especially in moments where I hold a privileged identity, right? If I'm going around into spaces where advocacy needs to happen and I'm the white guy, yep, I'm making fun of the biggest, dumbest thing I can find. If that's all, if that's the last tool I have in my hand, I'm going out wielding it.
What does the reclamation of redneck mean to you, both personally and politically?
Well, redneck is a slur, yeah, and so there's a much larger history in America anyway, that most folks should be able to think of examples of slurs being reclaimed by minoritized communities. And redneck has been reclaimed a couple times. It was reclaimed, I don't know when the term started, because it's a very old pejorative. It's as old as white trash. So redneck was sometime, you know, as soon as America began to colonize. For laborers, for what would become, you know, blue collar people who did the manual labor, the lowest class of people, of white people in America. But the term became a signifier and synonymous with labor unionizing and resistance in coal country and in steel parts of Appalachia. When coal mining unions literally went to war with enforcers to try to earn rights to better working and living conditions. So there's this whole history of the company town. So reclaiming redneck has already happened a couple times in the history of America. So contemporary reclaiming redneck, I think, is more along the lines of what we were discussing earlier, trying to claw back against the more harmful parts of how we view people with those experiences. It could also be personal. So maybe Beck has a totally different answer.
No, I feel the same way. It's about fighting back against the stereotypes and things that just aren't true. Appalachians are, you know, we're not a monolith. We're not all the same. We all have different hopes and dreams and those kinds of things. But that gets diminished when people just write us off as being dumb rednecks or something like that. So I'm very proud of it. I take it back just like I took back the word queer. If you're going to call me that, I'm going to own it, you know?
What future topics or collaborations are you both excited about exploring on Queer Next?
I really have enjoyed, we never planned to have guests or anything like that. We never planned for this to become a thing. Like, we were just kind of doing something that sounded fun to us. And so the idea that people even want to be on the show is kind of wild. But I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of interest in, and both from like our academic backgrounds, there's a history project, an sort of oral history project with another show that wants to collaborate with us on information access and doing, you know, we're researchers at heart, we're academics. I mean, so incorporating some more like real content about the Appalachian region, I think would be like, who else is going to do that for folks? You know, like that's something that we can provide people that isn't going to happen in this kind of space, in accessible space. It's behind a paywall at a university, you know? So we want to, that's something we could do for free for folks.
What do you hope listeners, especially outside of Appalachia, to take away from hearing you all talk today and also listening to your episodes on Queer Next?
You know, something that has been a pleasant surprise is the number of listeners we have that are outside of the region of Appalachia. And we've all along been getting feedback from people who are shocked. They're like just coming right out and saying like, I can't believe how relatable you all are. Like in the short amount of time they spend listening to our show, I think they're realizing that Appalachia is not some alien planet. Yeah, our experiences are pretty particular, but you know, this is the most impoverished, population area in the country. This is, you know, like most widespread concentrated poverty per capita in the U.S. And that lends itself to a very particular kind of experience. But we are still people, and there are, and we also don't own, we are not the only place that experience exists in America. There's poverty and oppression and isolation and loss of access to resources all over the country. So I hope that we've continued to like resonate with people from outside Appalachia as well, and being able to demonstrate a kind of, that there are even across pretty distinct differences, still shared experiences and shared responses to experiences. I think people are able to imagine themselves through the stories we tell. They're able to kind of imagine themselves in a position that is different than one they've ever been in.
A special thank you to Beck and Dash for joining us today. Be sure to check out their podcast, Queer Next, available on all podcasting platforms. I'm Lee Wade, and thank you for listening to Translucent.